Welcome to Cycle Systems Academy podcast, and as I am an avid listener to the main Velocast feed, I'm extremely pleased that I am 1,458 kilometres from John Galloway right now, and that's because they've just announced that Paris-Roubaix has been postponed, and I think, John, you said if Paris-Roubaix was postponed again, someone was getting punched.
I think the closest person I can punch is probably Scott.
Okay.
It's good to be said, they're rescheduling it for October, apparently. I like the idea of it in October purely from the weather point of view.
Yep.
And we don't want bad weather so people will crash. We want it because it really highlights the talents that get you through Paris-Roubaix. But if we have another year without one, life won't be worth living. I mean, it's my favourite race of the year by far.
It is. I mean, it's somewhat surprising to me that Tour of Flanders is still going to be on Sunday. I mean, we're recording on Good Friday here, guys. And as some wag said, if that was a Good Friday, I wouldn't want a bad one.
What are you doing for Friday? Oh, it's a good day. I'm going to get crucified.
Yeah. I didn't even know, because at Cycle Systems, we just work through the bank holidays because we've got to deliver these courses and we're full pretty much every week of the year. So I took the dog out this morning, you know, about 8 o'clock or something. And I thought, oh, roads are quiet. It's fucking bank holiday, isn't it? You know?
Yeah. And I know about bank holidays because of my posting, you know, because we take them all off. And I was up People's High Street today and it was heaving with cars covered in bikes because we've got Glen Tress and stuff. Yep. So I had kind of the opposite experience, but it's a good day. So I'm happy. What are we going to talk about today, Sean? It's been a while because you've had such interesting guests. I'm feeling slightly intimidated. I've got some performance anxiety here.
Well, I just saw on Skype it said chatted 3 months ago to JG, but of course you've been exceptionally busy with the Velocast with all of the millions of races kicking off on Eurosport. What I wanted was to do a bit of a kind of tech update, because there's been loads of things that have caught my eye, lots of proper WTF moments that didn't seem to be commented on in the original articles, and also wanted to look at the whole deep fake thing, because one of the things with the massive lack of supply of bikes and bike parts that everyone is talking about, and in fact, the latest Nerd Alert podcast has got a fantastic section all about that from someone who works deep in the bike industry, designing bikes and sourcing parts. And apparently, because of the lack of parts, there's a real danger for consumers or even shops ending up with fake kit.
Yeah.
Because, like Graham said on last week's pod, 8-speed cassettes are the new, you know, rocking horse shit, really. So people are looking at buying boxes of cassettes from Alibaba and stuff. And it's really concerning that people could be putting stuff on their bikes or even customers' bikes that's going to be dangerous. So I wanted to look briefly at a short book, really, written by Carlton Reed, a recent guest for Bike Biz, and it was all about faking it, and the article's called Faking It. I'll put the link on the show notes.
I think I lost about an hour and a half of my life reading this last night.
Well, I wouldn't say lost, because I enjoyed reading it, but it is certainly incredibly in-depth, and there's a few really good sort of points in there, salient points that was worth looking at, and a few questions and such as well, really. So let's get into that now. And I think the most common thing you'll hear said about fake bikes, you know, or fake components or what have you, because it's so common now, especially wheels. You know, people love getting the Alibaba rims and building them up. Even wheel builders and wheel companies will be doing this. And what people tend to say is it's just from the same factory and it's being sold without the branding and the big company's just ripping you off. So it's seen as kind of sticking it to the man, often by people who have not got the stones to stick it to the man in any other way in their lives or any way that counts. I'll stick it to the man as long as the organic avocados still keep coming, right? Yep. So not credible at all, guys. But of course, it's also complete and utter nonsense. And the great thing about this short book or article, if you will, by Carlton, is he actually talks to the factories that make these Ginarellos and all of this stuff. And they say, oh, no, Pinarello have got their own factory. And the most important point is, of course, if you're making components of Pinarello or Specialized or Trek or what have you, there's no way you're going to risk that contract by knocking out a load of counterfeits.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big area. And, you know, we all, particularly as you say with wheels, we know people who bought stuff at a ridiculous price. We've even seen, OEM stuff from less well-known manufacturers that fails unexpectedly, and it's because it comes from these lower tiers of factories. I will say, and I'm going to be accused of some bias towards China here, so I'm being completely open towards that. I first went to China in 2013, and you could buy counterfeit everything everywhere. The last time I was there, it was much harder. And I've seen a similar thing happening in, you know, the guitar world. We've got Chinarellos in cycling. There's Gibsons. You know, they're fake Gibsons in the guitar world. And I think the whole Chinese economy is moving away from this kind of backroom trader thing a wee bit. I think there's a push towards catering for their own growing and wealthy middle class. But I do think it's still a huge problem. And you're right. The whole COVID situation and the difficulties with supplies. I mean, the bike that I was ordered for the trip to China, which I've cancelled just now because there's a few things up in the air. I ordered it in September and it was due for a delivery, I think about 4 weeks ago, originally. Mm-hmm. And that's someone within the trade is having to wait that long. If I ordered it now, God only knows when I'd get the thing. So there is a real drive for people to be able to get stuff, and that's pushing them in directions that might risk their customers. You know, if it's a metal thing that's a counterfeit, it's bad enough. But carbon, I mean, how often have we said on this show, when carbon fails, it fails catastrophically. Low-grade carbon is the worst thing that you could put your leg over and pedal.
Yeah, absolutely, other than maybe a robot sex to me.
Was it sex arses? Did you see the man whose sex arses were stuck at the channel by Brexit?
Was that a genuine thing? Because it was the Sunday Sport or something, wasn't it?
I hope it was a genuine thing. I really do.
Well, if anyone listening has had their sex arse delayed, you know, let us know about it. So obviously, we're very concerned about that. But I think one of the things that I've always struggled with the bike industry, or capitalism, full stop, is the horrific exploitation of workers potentially. And you just don't know. There's no kind of fair trade sticker, is there? You know, you can get your organic fair trade, Rainforest Alliance coffee and all the rest of it, ground by a hipster's armpit and everything. But in terms of bikes, you just don't know what you're getting, a bit like everything else. But in Carlton's article, he talks about the giant factory. You know, they've got one in China, one in Taiwan. Now, they're making bikes, obviously, for themselves. They're making bikes for Scott, for Colnago, all sorts of other companies. Mm. And what he says here is each frame takes 18 hours to produce, goes through 32 different pairs of hands, and they're all highly skilled individuals to get a job at this factory because there's so many skilled and semi-skilled individuals in China in manufacturing. It visits 14 quality control stations. And while it's labor-intensive, the workers clock on at 8, go home at 5:30, they have breaks for tea and lunch. They've got a relatively good work life. They probably haven't got a union, but compared to the images of people working for a dollar a day and indentured labor and everything, that's not what we're seeing because these are really good quality factories, and often the people running them are actually educated in the West and have more of those Western values.
It's funny, I mean, my boy in China, Alex, his girlfriend's mother works, it's actually in tech, it's not in, you know, a component manufacturer for bicycling or anything. But she works in one of these factories that Carlton's talking about. Monday to Friday, she actually stays in dormitories on site.
Yeah.
All of their food's, you know, all their food's provided for them. They have basic but, you know, functional health care. And then they get, you know, decent holidays and home for the weekend. And by Chinese standards, that's a real step forward. So you're right. You know, we should applaud these companies that are making real efforts. And, you know, you see, particularly in the tech world, articles about the likes of Apple and that kind of thing. And what people forget when they're talking about that is where you're starting from. You know, these are real steps forward, and you can't expect them to change completely overnight. So when you look at the likes of Giant or Carbotech or any of these big A-grade manufacturers, they're treating people pretty well. So when you buy those components, you don't need to worry about where they're coming from. You know they're coming from a place where, by the standards of the country and by the standards of many places in the West, the employees are being treated well and, you know, health and safety is being taken seriously.
Yep, and the same goes for all the big components, SRAM, obviously Shimano with their factories in both Taiwan and Japan, mm-hmm. and Campagnolo, as we know, it's all made either in Italy or in Romania to very high standard. So essentially, there's still a lot of people out there, though, that want to get these fake bikes, or I say especially wheels and components and such. And I remember Mike Jenner, who we hope to have back on the podcast soon, because he's spannering currently for Trek Segafredo women's team. And as you know, they're having an incredibly successful time. So when Mike has got a bit of time, he's going to come back on the pod. But Mike, of course, used to teach at Cycle Systems Academy when we first came to Devon. And he was working just for a domestic team in the UK at the time, Starley. And Starley was one of these companies that used what's called an open mold. So in Carlton's article, he's talking about the top factories. So the people like, you know, Giants and Carbotech and the such. Then you've got the open mold, the middle factories, and then the complete cowboys that we'll talk about. So the likes of Planet X and Dolan and all the rest of it, they're using these open mold frames, which is a big step down from the premium, but there's still a level of quality control and decent quality going in. But of course, there's quite a lot of real cowboy components fitted to those bikes often, mm-hmm. for them to hit the price point. A bit like Carlton said when he spoke to us, it's easy to start a bike brand. Now, we've had graduates who started bike brands straight after doing level two.
Yeah.
They just import stuff from Far East, whack some stickers on it, get a Facebook page, and off you go. And with this Starley, one of the guys had a crash in one of the Tour Series crits and broke his bars. And it's not surprising, you know, 180 gram carbon bars, they snapped on a crash. But Mike showed me and he said, look at this, Sean, the concerns on the other side. On the other side, he showed me where the STI shifter had been clamped on. Mike had done it, so he'd obviously used all of the correct prep paste and torque wrenches and everything. Yep. And when he removed the STI, there was a huge indentation in the carbon.
Terrible.
So what Mike said is this bar was coming apart anyway. And this is exactly the same kit that was being sold to people. And it's very tempting when you see a carbon fiber, 7 kilo Dura-Race DI2 equipped bike for 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 less than the opposition. You think, why wouldn't you? And this is one of the issues, is as you say, aftermarket components or too good to be two prices, it really is too good to be true.
Yeah.
I remember I worked at a wonderful bike shop, I mentioned it last week, Walton Street Cycles in Oxford. And the boss, was also a John with red hair, actually, who's no longer with us, tragically. So God rest you, John.
Well, thanks for that cheery thought, mate.
Well, John, he looked like a Viking. He was about 6 foot. He had long red hair and a big red beard. And he was so scary and intimidating, people would be afraid to go in the shop. You know, people would say, you work for that fucking guy. Mm. That guy scares me. But he was heart of gold, but he was a bike shop owner. So he was stressed and upset and angry all the time. And I remember we were just hanging out in the shop one day, nothing much happening. And this, because obviously, you know, most of your customers in the bike trade. And this customer came in and said, John, look, this was the Lance Armstrong era. I've got this same replica Trek off eBay for £400. Isn't it great? And John just went, well, you bought a fucking stolen bike, you twat. He expected him to go, hooray. And it's like, well, no, there's no such thing as a bargain like that. So it's the same with these, it looks too good to be true bargains. It really is. And like you said, the big, big danger here, to paraphrase a 1,000-page article, you don't know what you're getting.
Yeah.
So just because your friend bought a Cinerello frame from AliExpress and it's fine, which they may be massively overbuilt and, you know, built on a good day and it's completely safe, but there's no guarantee that the other one won't just crumble underneath you. And I think that's the big, big problem of absolutely any component. And as you say, especially carbon.
Yeah, I mean, I sent you a picture just before we started recording of a Gibson Les Paul that Alex bought in China. And he knew what he was buying. You know, I've educated the kids about guitars, so you know, he knows that you don't get Les Pauls for 250 quid or whatever. And it's a fantastic guitar. All I had to do was change the pickups, and it plays beautifully. It's got Gibson in the headstock. It's not a Gibson. You know, where it comes from is open to debate. They have the same debates in the guitar world as they have in the cycling world about fakes. But it was Alex's only way to get a guitar, and he needed a guitar to play. You know, if you're a guitarist or were you, you know, you're a piper, it's like biting your nails or whatever. If you bite your nails, it's a compulsion. You just need a guitar to play. And it's fantastic. I've played some that are terrible. And that's the problem. You don't have the quality control. You don't have the consistency. And if, you know, your guitar goes out of tune quite easily or your pots are scratchy or whatever, that's a bad thing. But if your fork snaps and you hit the ground, that's much, much worse. So usually I'm big for a bargain. But when it comes to carbon, it comes back to if it's too good to be true, it is. You know, it just is. Don't buy cheap carbon. You'd be better off with a well-made aluminium frame or even, God forbid, you know, steel, and the same with components. I'd much rather be on a medium-level aluminium seat post, stem and bars than a cheap as dirt carbon setup.
Yeah, and it is worth saying that, of course, you know, there are failures from big brands, and we'll talk about some quite high-profile ones recently.
Horrifying ones.
Yeah, exactly. I really love the Trek Madone bike. I just think it's the best-looking bike in the peloton at the moment. Mm-hmm. And I'm part of a Trek Madone owners group, even though I haven't got one at the moment on Facebook, but it's just nice to see what people are saying about it.
You're just hanging out and grooming other Trek Madone owners.
And what you see there again and again and again, it's often someone's first post when they join that group, is what's wrong with my fork crown? Because of the really deep fork crown and deep head tube, it rubs, and it just rubs material away. And it's just a known defect. And this is one of the best bikes out there. It's ridden in the world tour, yada, yada, yada. But it's shit. This shouldn't be happening. And then, of course, there's all of the famous carbon fiber failures that we see both in the Pro Peloton and on the Raul Lucia videos, etc. And while things seem to be better, if you buy, you know, that your Colnago or your Giant or your Pinarello or what have you, you still need to make sure that it's been assembled correctly, you know, by a, you know, competent, preferably trained mechanic, got to say that. But if you're buying second hands, you just don't know.
Yeah, you don't know. You're going to have to.
You need to send it to Carbon Bike Repair in Surrey or to Raoul if you're in Australia. They need to scan it and look at it. And you could end up paying $1,500 for a repair on a bike that someone's selling for the same price. So the whole second hand market in carbon, as it's at least 20 years old in popular retail, yeah, there could be a whole load of bikes that have been knocked around and that are about to fold. And something that made me laugh in an article on Outside Online was Matt Shriver, Trek's Belgium-based technical director. He was talking about a widely reported in crash when a Trek Demand carbon fiber split in half. It doesn't say in which direction, but split in half in a crash, I assume front to back. And Shriver said, turns out the guy fell on the frame during the crash. That kind of impact could cause any material to break. Now, I don't know about you, John, but I know you're not a small lad. If you fell off on any steel frame that you owned, do you think you'd snap it in two by landing on it?
No, I think I'd probably snap my scrotum in two by landing on it, but not the bike frame.
I think so. I say an aluminium frame, you'd be hard pushed to snap in two by landing on it. I mean, maybe if you landed on the top tube and it was one of those, you know, the early aluminium frames, like the early Principia's, which the Linda McCartney Principia's, yeah. You could squeeze the down tube. And it'd go boom, boom, like a can of Coke. You'd probably break one of those, but it's not necessarily the best frame for everyone. Like the reason my gravel bike is aluminium, apart from cost, is so I can throw it over fences, I can chuck it around, I can, you know, just be quite happy knocking around on it and bashing it and not worrying that all of these structural properties that I can't see, i.e. the fibers, have been broken by some sort of mishandling or crash.
You know, it's funny. I mean, my Stormford Taylor is steel, of course, but it's got an Envy carbon fork, which I had examined after I bought it because it had been a demo bike, so I wanted to check it hadn't been, you know, abused. And I'm still thinking about getting Richard Hallett to build me a lovely steel fork for it. Because carbon, we've talked about this before. If you lay aside the environmental concerns, there is no better material to make a bike frame out of. You can tune every aspect of the frame to perform exactly as you want it to, without any compromise whatsoever in the materials. You know, if you need an extra layup somewhere to add a bit of stiffness, you add the extra layup. I remember talking to Ben Sirota. I think there were 280 pieces in the layup of his carbon bike's bottom bracket alone. Mm. You know, so you can really fine tune everything. But when it comes to failure, it goes catastrophically. That's not good. And buying a second-hand carbon bike for me, and why I got the fork on the Stomper looked at, is no different from buying a second-hand climbing rope. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't know what's been done to it. You don't know if it's been stored beside the battery acid in the boot of somebody's car. You don't know how many crampons have been put through it. There's all sorts of things that can go through. And if your life depends on it, I'd get something that doesn't feel catastrophically. But we're sounding like old men now.
Well, let's get completely with it then. Let's look at both Canyon and Factor. And do the kids still say epic fail? I don't know.
I don't think so, no.
It's getting a bit old now, isn't it, that? You know, I don't think the drill guys say epic fail, do they, when they're talking about chefing someone in the neck? Maybe that would be an epic win, I don't know. But anyway.
You're too epically young for me. I've got drill, is that kind of music?
Yeah, it's the modern version of gangster rap, basically, but it's British. It's funny because, as with any type of music, there's a staggering amount of creativity and musical genius that's involved in it. But it's not exactly Malcolm X or Martin Luther King, put it that way, or Public Enemy, right? But anyway, respect to people's creativity. Anyway, getting back to bikes. Canyon, yeah, they've really fucked the pooch, as they say, in several ways, and one of which has been the seat post on the new Air Road. Now, I don't know if any of you listening, or John, if you heard the excellent Nerd Alert, where they actually spoke to the designers of the Air Road. Cycling Tips do this. They go in and they say, look, you need to allow us to ask any question and we'll speak to you about the design of the bike. And there was all sorts of fascinating discussion on that about why you wouldn't necessarily want a 7-to-1 bike, that kind of thing, even though you can now. But what they didn't say is the seat post really sucks big time. And it's much more structurally built up at the front than the back. And there's actually quite a lot of movement and flex in the seat post while the Air Road's being ridden. Mm-hmm. And the more seat post you've got showing and the bigger the rider you are, the more it's going to flex. And
bigger lever and bigger force, it's simple.
Basically, yeah, on what's something that really seems to be not fit for purpose, they've engineered quite a small amount of carbon inside the frame because they're going for lightweight, stiff, comfort, all the rest of it. And it seems to be a compromise too far, as well as some basic bad engineering. And it's just rubbing. Mm-hmm. It's just rubbing away and degrading and then moving. And of course, at some point, the things are going to snap. And, you know, if you bought a Canyon, like we've been saying, bikes and components are hard to get now. So you might have waited X amount of time for this bike. It's just come out. Everyone's saying how amazing it is. Matthew Van Der Poel's winning races on it. More on that in a sec. And then the seat post is wobbling around. And there's nothing you can do. And as we speak right now on the 2nd of April, Good Friday, they haven't got a fix.
No.
They have not got a fix. So you've got a bike that cost a huge amount of money, even though they're relatively affordable. It's a massive amount of money for a bike where the seat post doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And this issue, I wanted to bring it up because it's an issue of proprietary. You know, bikes are better than ever, aren't they? You know, yeah. They're more aero, the tires have got less rolling resistance, they're less likely to puncture, they're incredibly comfy, the gears set themselves up. But as the bikes, mostly to look cool for most of us, let's face it, have all of these proprietary forks, proprietary stems, proprietary headsets, proprietary seat posts. If there's one weak link, the entire thing's unrideable.
Yeah.
Whereas in the past, you'd be like, oh, well, I'll just get myself a nice Salsa seat clamp or, you know, get a Bontranger seat post and off you go.
Yeah.
And like I've said a few times, my kind of golden age for bikes was that kind of 11 speed, you know, 2011, 2012 kind of era where most of the tubes were round, most of the forks had a standard steerer, most bikes had a standard seat post, although there was quite a lot of integrated seat masts in that era. And you could just swap things out nice and easily, whereas you can't do that now. And it's causing some quite major problems. So what else did Canyon get wrong, John?
Well, talking about seat posts, I mean, that problem is bad enough if you're in a nice place with good weather. Mm. If you're in Scotland or, you know, looking at some of your pictures recently when you've been out in bad weather in Switzerland, that slight movement of the seat post is going to be pumping crap down into the seat tube.
Yeah, well, that's what they said on Road CC, is that it's exacerbated by the grinding pace from bad weather, of course.
You know.
So
the other thing that Canyon have noticeably done recently is left Mathieu van der Poel with only half a handlebar.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching that race live, like I think you were, for Velocast, and I was like, what's going on with his bar? And it looked to be, because I know these bikes, if you've not seen them, guys, I'll put a link on the show notes, but they've got folding handlebars so they can put them in boxes because, of course, Canyon are a mail order only company.
Yeah.
And the bar snapped, but it was quite obvious straight away. It snapped at the shifter and brake lever point. And that's just your classic, either cheap, nasty carbon bar or someone's over-tightened the shifter. So Mathieu amazingly didn't crash, obviously. Guy's got some bike handling skills, has been documented. But since then, Canyon have issued a stop ride on all of these bikes.
Which you've paid how many thousands of pounds for, and it's your pride and joy, and we're finally getting out of some kind of lockdown so we can go out with a couple of our mates, and you're left without a bike.
Yeah, because again, you can't just put a standard bar in there. It's all integrated cables and, you know, specialist this and that. And again, they said, oh, yeah, well, we'll have a replacement soon. But again, with all of the issues with shipping and such around the world and boats getting stuck in canals, it's definitely not going to be quick. So obviously, you're better off going to your local bike shop, guys. I would say that. But get to your local bike shop, skilled mechanics, and these internet price shaggers, as they're known in the trade. It might look like a great deal, but actually not so much.
If you want to break into the bike trade, train your staff, or even learn some new skills just for fun, Cycle Systems Academy has a course for you. Our graduates come to us from all over the globe and train with us to gain the highest recognised cycle mechanic qualifications available. The bike industry supports and believes in Cycle Systems Academy, which means they'll believe in you too.
So let's get on to the next one, which is Factor. And Factor...
Actually, before we move on to Factor, can we look at the bike that Mathieu van der Poel used in Strade Bianche?
Yep.
Because they replaced the handlebars, and then they appeared to drill a massive hole in the down tube for the internal cabling. It was really weird.
I didn't notice that. Whereabouts in the down tube?
Just above the logo. I'm going to have to go back and look at it. Because what we're talking about here is, you know, all of that perfect layup and stress analysis and all of that stuff I was talking about. You can't then just take a drill bit and put a hole in it for a cable to go somewhere.
Oh, my God. And, well, thankfully it stayed in one place for his superhuman, maybe peak too soon performance.
It can't have been that weak with those watts he was putting out. It made me smile.
Well, the thing is, it's just lucky. It's a bit like the second generation Campagnolo EPS where you had to drill a hole in the frame for the battery charger? And you had, you know, Graham Priest and King saying, well, I'll show you how to drill a carbon frame softly. And it's like, no, you fucking won't, mate.
No, thanks.
No, you won't. No. That is not happening. You wonder why you don't see EPS on anywhere except the pros bikes. So thanks for pointing that out. I'll grab a photo of that. I didn't see it. But Factor, who again, another sort of direct customer brand, they've had a lot of publicity recently, people like Chris Froome riding on them. They had a broken steerer
Yeah.
just the other day, so completely snapped off steerer, Again, the Ostrovam is the bike that it is. And again, the rider didn't fall off, which is staggering because these failures are happening in Belgian classics and stuff, you know, where it's easy enough to crash anyway. But this is what stood out for me. I'm going to read the quote. And this is from the pro team, I think. So we had a batch issue with our compression plug. So this is the plug that sits inside the fork steerer that holds everything together. Because, of course, you can't use an aluminium star nut that you hammer in like you would in a metal fork.
Yeah.
We saw that the outside surface received a clear anodized coating over the specified sandblast to white metal. So essentially this bung which holds itself inside the carbon steerer was moving because there's a clear coating over the roughed up surface.
It's there. A friction fit that's been given something yeah. smooth and slippy.
Yeah. This caused the surface roughness to be too low and led to preload issues. So preload is to get the bearings preloaded correctly so nothing moves and wobbles, and nor does it interfere with the steering smoothness. The team responded at camps. This is team mechanics for Chris Froome and Alex Dowsett and all the other sport washing bastards. He said the team responded at camps and early season races by torquing these progressively higher.
Oh, Jesus.
Team mechanics, and there will be a maximum torque level. Like Trek have got a maximum torque level for these bolts, even though there isn't a set torque. And finally, say what now? Finally, by bonding in the plug while tightening it to ensure that the headset stayed tight.
Unbelievable.
That's right. Supposedly the best mechanics in the world. And look, Blem went to this team with Froomey, and you know Blem is an incredible mechanic. They glued in an unfunctional part. A part's been made incorrectly. Rather than demanding a proper one, they glued one in for the likes of Alex Dowsett and Chris Froome and all the rest of it to be travelling at speeds of up to 60, 65 miles an hour or 100k an hour.
Do you know the bit that I particularly enjoy? Yeah, the bit that I particularly enjoy about that is they glued it in, having potentially overloaded the carbon surface and damaging it to the point where it might fail at any point.
Exactly.
You know, on a 5,200 pound frame set.
It's absolutely staggering, isn't it? So what, I'm not going to rush out and buy a Factor anytime soon, and probably it's going to be the same for quite a lot of other people too. And here is another quote here, because they've removed all the bikes. The team is off the bikes because the bonding left us unable to change the plug. Funny that, don't try that one at home. Even if the forks were not bonded, we're worried they could be permanently damaged after an over-torque occurred, yeah. leading us to make the decision to replace all of the team forks.
Do you know what? I mean, this is the year I've been really critical of Factor bikes, not because of their function up to now, because I think the people who have designed them are people who know what they want from a bike. But I've always thought they look crap. And this is the first year I've looked at it, and albeit it's £5,200, but that comes with a ceramic speed bottom bracket and headset, which is, you know, a good few hundred quid of that.
You can look at that while you're in your hospital bed, can't you?
They actually look really nice this year. But this this beggars belief. If I caught a mechanic in a shop I was managing doing that, I'd sack them on the spot.
It is gross misconduct, isn't it? Yeah. If someone did that in an assessment, you know, we do bike build assessments, they would fail the assessment. You know?
I'd genuinely sack someone for that.
Yeah,
because you've potentially got a customer then going out, hitting a bump, their fork fails because the steerer fails because it's been compromised by over-tightening, even before you add God knows what chemicals in the glue that you're using,
yeah.
and hits a bump and the fork collapses.
Yeah. Oh. I think the lad hit a curb, didn't he, when the steerer broke. So it's staggering. It's the sort of thing I'd be shocked if my son did it. You know, to one of his mates' bikes. But for supposedly, you know, the best mechanics in the world, it really, really shows that if you're under pressure, you know, if the pressure's on, then you can make bad decisions. Yeah. And people obviously did. Yeah.
Yeah. I genuinely considered, because I read this yesterday, you sent the doc through yesterday, I had to check the dates to make sure it wasn't a particularly bad mechanic-led April Fool.
I did wonder. I mean, obviously, I did create this doc on April Fool's Day, and like we were saying before recording, it seems to have lost its relevance in the world we live in, because we live in a world where the day-to-day is the news.
Yeah.
Alan Partridge is, you know, a respected political columnist nowadays, and yeah, we are completely beyond satire, potentially by design as well. So April's Fool, it's kind of like, what?
Yeah.
You know? So it's hard to tell what's what, isn't it, basically? So I did come across a great article, though, which made me giggle. And I think the thing about it for me is it could so easily not be an April Fool. So this is our friends who we much respect at Bike Rumor, which is spelled the American way, or the incorrect way, if you like. And it was a story about Bomb Track, who must be some cool down with the kids jump bike brand or something, I don't know. And it was a BSA 47 threaded bottom bracket, which was basically a mullet bottom bracket with T47 on the drive side and BSA on the non-drive side. Of course,
this is quite a good idea.
Well, actually, you can see the merit in it. But of course, you need the proprietary frame and cranks and everything. And the thing is, there's far, far worse ideas being bought out in the bike industry all the time, including most of the bottom bracket standards.
How often have we talked about bottom brackets? I genuinely looked at this and thought, actually, yeah, I can see the sense behind that.
Well, if you look, I think it was on the Bike Rumor Facebook page or Twitter or somewhere it was posted, and loads of people responding in all seriousness. There was all sorts of technical drawings, you know, of all the specifications and the sizes. So someone took a lot of love and care into this.
My favourite bit was the two sides being joined by a hearth joint.
Yeah. I didn't notice that. I must have skipped over that bit. Bit of Campagnolo. But look, we have been a proper pair of moaning old mechanics, haven't we, so far, guys? So let's look at something really cool, really wonderful. And this is Ronan McLaughlin's Everesting bike.
Oh, yeah.
So Ronan McLaughlin, I'm sure you've all seen, broke the Everesting world record, where you need to ride the entire height of Everest on the same climb, up, down, over, over, and over. He did it up in Donegal. Looks absolutely gorgeous. I mean, I want to go to Donegal for the music. You know, they got their own particular fiddle style, which is quite influenced by the Scottish style up there, which is really exciting. And I want to go up there for a bit of mountain biking. And now I want to ride this climb on the road bike as well. But anyway, Ronan has got a great article on the Cycling Tips website. I'll chuck a link up to it for the bike that he rode. And it was really clever build, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, a wonderful mix of stuff that reminded me very much of the heyday of time trial and development, you know, when we were just discovering aero stuff.
Yeah.
And you were gathering bits, you know, XTR seat posts, because you could put them in compact frames and they wouldn't flex and all that kind of stuff. Ronan's bike really reminds me of that. And what really appealed to me as an ex-tester is he's the first person, I think, who's realised that if you're, you know, going for an Everesting speed effort, then the time you spend coming down is just as important as the time you spend going up. You know, if you can save 2 or 3 seconds every time you're descending back to the start of your climb, it adds up over the attempt. So, you know, you've got a tri fairing at the front, you've got a cassette made of a mix of parts with effectively 7 speed, but with an 11 tooth sprocket that's only there to clamp it on, you know, to make the cassette lock ring fix. Really careful choice of wheels, bars. It's just a beautifully thought out single purpose machine, and it made me smile a lot when I read the article.
Yeah, really wonderful. I mean, it's kind of funny because he said, I didn't have much money. And then he's got AX Lightness wheels and Dura-Race DI2 and everything. But I think a lot of the equipment was actually donated and sponsored. And, you know, it makes me remember, you know, back to really up till the mid-noughties, when a lot of the UCI rules tightened down, and you'd see pro bikes and they were really blinged out and trick and different to what you see on the shops. Whereas now, a lot of pros' bikes, apart from the geometry and the gearing, the only real difference to a stock bike would be ceramic bearings everywhere. Yeah. You know, I've not wanted to do a Paris-Roubaix bike sorry, John, or Tour of Flanders bike this year, or what bikes are the pros on? Because it's just boring.
It's just the same bike they're on the rest of the time with slightly lower tyre pressures a lot of the time.
Yeah, and bigger tyres now, you know. I guess we could talk more about pro tyres. And actually, tyres was the only mistake Ronan made, because he had a blowout on the descent, and he was on the super, super light coarser speed tubulars. And obviously with no sealant in, he was just going for the lowest weight, taking a chance, and the tyre blew out. But he managed to swap to a new bike and then a spare bike for one lap, as it were, up and down. And the mechanic had put a new wheel in for him by the time, you know, he'd got back down. And it's a good job it was a rim brake bike, otherwise the mechanic would still be trying to change the wheel, yeah, wouldn't he?
Well, we've seen some of that this year, haven't we, by the roadside?
Shimano neutral service. when they're not knocking riders off. And it has been, the thing is, when we did the second ever Cycle Systems Academy podcast, back when it was still Velocast Tech 5, we talked about this and how the wheel changes are slower, yeah, and they still are potentially losing races for people, right?
Yeah. I tell you, the other thing that really was interesting for me was the monitoring he was doing of his own body. He was doing real-time blood sugar monitoring, you know, which is hugely impressive. There's a wee sensor that fits in your arm, apparently, and an app on your phone, which lets you analyse your carbohydrate usage and the concentration of available energy in your blood at any given point during the ride.
There's probably one for professional riders where it puts drugs in at just the right time.
They use it for Team Novadix, Cure-All, type 1 diabetes guys?
Yeah,
they use it to manage their insulin requirements during races and energy balance.
Amazing. Maybe Ineos have got some pot Belgian there.
Shh.
Drip, drip, drip. I'll just briefly on that, you know, it's really funny for myself because I hung out with Shane Sitton and Dave B and everything at the just after the launch of Team Sky, after the first successes in the classics. And Dave was saying he was really thrilled with Yogi, Ian Stannard's third place in Kern, Brussels Kern. Mm-hmm. He said it meant more to him than Fletcher's win in Het Volk a few days before, because the whole point of the team was for clean British riders to stay clean and complete at the top.
Mm.
And I kind of always thought, why would he lie to a nobody like me about that, hanging out in Manchester Velodrome? So, because we were talking about training mechanics. And I've always thought that was genuine. And I don't know if that's me just being dumb, because obviously there was stuff going down, as we can see now. There's too much. There's too many lies being told. There's too much come up that it's something peculiar. But I'm still not as convinced as many seem to be that we've all just been duped by a US postal type scandal.
It's difficult. I mean, my feeling is, I think it's entirely possible that he was being completely genuine when you were there. And then they realised, actually, we can't compete, you know, and things changed. I think that stuff's going to trickle out. I mean, it always does. It always does. And it could be that it was just a subset of people centred around, you know, Freeman or Sutton or whatever. But we don't know the whole truth yet. And it's kind of pointless to speculate beyond the point, because I genuinely think stuff will come out now. Because one thing about British journalists is they love to support people when they're successful, but by God, they love to take them down by the ankles like a pack of hyenas once they show the slightest sign and feet of clay. So there are people digging deep, deep, deep into the team now. So I think we will actually find out what went on.
It is. I mean, it's another thing that I'm slightly comfortable with, because the people that are calling, you know, for this, it's like the Daily Mail, British MPs. It's like clean your own house up first, right? You know, these are the people with the lowest standards of public life we've ever seen. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's another thing. And the really fascinating thing about Everesting, which is actually sort of run and monitored by Andy van der Breggen, who's like the cycling tips guy as well. And, you know, we're not seeing a minute off or 2 minutes off. You know, we're seeing Contador being smashed by 20 minutes and then another 20 minutes. And it's, as you say, it's because it's so early that things like, oh yeah, we need an aero bike for going downhill, which, you know, Ronan's bike is the first one I've seen that mention.
Yeah.
But now it's obvious, isn't it? Now he's said it. So I think we're going to see sub-7-hour everything, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, it really does remind me of that early 90s period of time trialing. It even made me smile when, to get a certain bit to fit, he had to take a hacksaw to it and then apply some gaffer tape.
Yep.
I mean, I remember using endless cable ties and, you know, routing the bit where it zips shut to the back of the bar so that it would be out of the wind shadow and all that kind of stuff.
All proper bike mechanics there, John.
So this is what we're seeing here, and it genuinely warms the cockles of my heart. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah. Have I told the story on the podcast about the guy who came into Beeline Bikes when my friend was head mechanic there in Oxford?
No.
And he said, I want this time trial bike built. And he gave Dan all the bits, this guy Dan. And Dan looked at it all and he said, well, no, because if I build the bike as you want it, you'll be looking backwards. You know, it was so low. That's when people just thought lower was better, you know. Yeah. And the guy said, and Dan said, you'd be looking backwards. And he goes, yeah, that's why I've got you this. And he pulled a little mirror out of his pocket.
I had one of those.
And he said, glue it onto the head tube.
That was a product you could buy that clamped to your stem.
Well, so there we go. So Beeline refused to build it, you know, which I think was quite wise. So this bloke got in a huff and said, I'll build it myself then, and stormed out. So he did build this bike himself. And his first ride on this, the test ride, he went round Oxford Ring Road, which, John, if you don't want to ride on British roads, I wouldn't ride on Oxford Ring Road. It's like a motorway. But he went out and he was killed. He was dead on his first ride.
This is going to be really good podcasting, but if you have a look at your DMs and Twitter, I've just sent you a picture of Steve McCaw riding the Scottish National 50.
Okay, I'll have to check that out, definitely. He's an original, isn't he?
Oh, very much so.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant. So live on Twitter, I'm going to have a look at this picture right now so I can see the guitar, picture of the guitar you sent me over. But getting into more good stuff, because this is a bit grim, isn't it? Getting into more good stuff. Something I really, really like the look of is this new Rode tire liner from Vittoria. So I'm a bit behind the times. I've still not got any tire liners on my mountain bikes or my gravel bikes. Mm-hmm. Keeps to be one of those things of, oh, I've got to do that. But I've been running a business and moving country and setting up a new business in Switzerland and all that. But Vittoria have got a 22-gram road tire liner. So what do you think of this, John?
I thought it was an incredibly elaborate April Fool.
I did wonder, actually. I actually went to Vittoria's website to check it wasn't.
It reminded me very much of the green tire. Do you remember the green tire?
No.
Well, it was a solid tire that you could... It was one of the many iterations of solid tires.
Yeah.
But actually, again, when you look at what's happened in mountain bike technology, it makes some sense.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, because the great thing about this is you see the picture of it when the tire's not inflated or in a cutaway, and the liner is the same volume as the inside of the tire. So it's been sold as a bit of run flat tech because it gives some volume to the tire if you're out of air, and it helps the bead snap into place.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is when you get air pressure in the tire, which most people do, it compresses the thing down to a quarter of its volume.
Yeah.
So you've still got the nice handling of an air-filled tire. Now, tubeless road tires, I've had, you know, really, really good experiences.
God, I hate recording shows around April the 1st, Sean. I'm looking at this and I'm still wondering.
Well, it's dated April the 2nd on Bike Rumour.
Phew.
That's what gave it away. So don't worry, we're not being taken here. And it's everywhere. It's all over the Vittoria site and such as well. That is totally genuine, this. So basically, I've had nothing but good experiences with tubeless road anyway, but I have seen tubeless road tires just shooting out jizz, you know, as people are riding along and all sorts of horror stories. In fact, at the moment, I just got the Swiss side wheels back out as the weather's getting well. And the Swiss are just not big on road tubeless tires at all.
Mm-hmm.
So none of the shops have had any in stock. So I just got myself some GP5000s with latex inner tubes and been tooling around on those. And, you know, inner tubes are great in road bikes too, aren't they?
But, I still prefer them, but, you know, we've had that discussion many times.
Yeah. I'll report back on the sidewalls of these GP5000s because lots and lots of people are reporting sidewall failures in them.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a real shame because the 4000 was just the best tyre ever, wasn't it?
It was certainly my choice.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's really nice. But yeah, this Vittoria Airliner Road, you get it in a little kit with some sealant. It's got a really trick little valve, which has got some nice little holes around the side at the top as well, that works really well with the liner. And you get the liner itself. So I'm going to give it a go because I have got some Vittoria Corsa Speed tyres sat back in England for me. Because we drove over here, like I said last week, with one carload of stuff. And I thought, oh, we'll be back in England in the spring.
Yeah.
You know? And of course, we can't come back yet. So I'm kind of a bit stranded from my tools and my kit. But probably to give Mike Stead an apoplectic fit, I've got a 23mm front tyre and a 25mm rear tyre, as recommended by Jean-Paul Ballard from Swisside for maximum benefit.
Awesome.
And they are going on whenever I can get back to England without quarantining for 10 days and grab a few paintings and some bike stuff, basically.
No, it'll be good. I tell you, I've been really jealous looking at your pictures because you're having a lot of fun there. I mean, you don't look the fittest you've ever looked. You looked a bit sweaty at the top of a climb the other day.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It does look like cycling heaven. It looks nearly as good as Peebles for cycling.
Well, I don't know if anywhere can beat Peebles, John. People do love it, don't they? But hey, that picture of Steve never came through, by the way.
Oh, well, never mind. I'll yeah, send you.
But no, I've been a bit out of shape, actually, and just been getting back into it. But I'll talk about that after we're recording because there's some funny stuff there. But it was really, really warm. I rode up Girton, the mountain here, and it was, oh, wow, there it is. And it was that 24, 25 degree day. I think you said even on the Scottish borders, it was 25 degrees. So that's quite a transition from going out in your long johns and all the rest of it. I don't just wear my long johns in the woods, but you know what I mean.
You can tell it's a while since we've chatted, actually, because we've been tangential even by our own standards.
Indeed.
I'm going to finish with the bike that I saw last week or the week before in Peebles in March. And I saw it from across the road, so I may be slightly wrong with a few of the components, but it was a Parley with DI2 and lightweight Mellonsteins in March in Scotland.
Dentist must be there on holiday illegally.
Do you know the coolest thing, though, and I genuinely, it made me smile, is there was a really nice Cube and a really nice, I think it was a Colnago.
Mm-hmm.
And the coolest bike was the Parley, and it was the only woman in the group.
Brilliant.
Brilliant. Lovely bike.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I bet. No, absolutely fantastic bikes. I think they're one of the few companies that will custom do the tubing for you, won't you? So you can choose the level of stiffness and give and all the rest of it in each tube in the bike.
Yeah. And carbon that is surprisingly not cheap.
Yeah, round tubes as well, so you can put a normal seat post in one as well. So I hope you enjoyed that, guys. That was a bit like our Christmas drinks pod, wasn't it? It was just a bit of a ramble, but there was just so many things that came in that if the factor guys are listening, you might want to send your mechanics to a training course, just saying.
If this entire show, that's the thing that is going to stick in my mind. The thought about a professional mechanic just torquing things harder until it sticks.
Jeez. I know, it's not Sunday in Hell, guys. You know, it's like the start of that film when the mechanic's just hitting the bike with a hammer, isn't it, to get things into place. So on that note, thanks for listening. I hope you're enjoying riding wherever you are in the world. Here in the Northern Hemisphere, things are getting warm again, although, you know, there's lockdowns across Europe again, things getting easier. So I hope you're not going too nuts, and podcasts and bikes and anything else that keeps you sane is keeping you sane. So thanks, John, and we'll see you all next week.